Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Good evening, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Welcome to this highly exciting event. Before we start, I'd like to make an acknowledgement of country. It's a sort of a slightly odd one tonight because there's about 1,200 of us here in this room on Gadigal land, the cradle of the great Eora Nation. And the person we're really here to see is beaming in to us from London. But listen, this is a sort of a connection that would have seemed quite strange to the Gadigal people over the incredibly lengthy time that they've been custodians of this land. However, you know, Gadigal people had an extraordinary way of telling stories across huge distances and indeed across millennia, so perhaps it's actually not so strange after all. And I would like, on behalf of all of us and our distant guest, to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land on which we meet tonight, most of us. And I am incredibly pleased to be able to introduce to you the singular Rachel Cusk. She's a highly prolific writer. She's published 11 novels and 4 works of non-fiction. She's been credited with, in her Outline trilogy, inventing a new novelistic form, which is not something that's regularly said about many people. She's a writer of profound technical skill and a chillingly acute observational eye, sometimes of bloviating fools at writers' festivals, so obviously slightly nervous. From The New Yorker, many experimental writers have rejected the mechanics of storytelling, but Cusk has found a way to do so without sacrificing its tension. Where the action meanders, language takes up the slack. Her sentences hum with intelligence, like a neural pathway. Her new novel, Second Place, is out next week, but the publishers have kindly made copies available tonight, so you, happy throng, will be the first in Australia to hold it in your trembling hands. But right now, will you please join me in welcoming to Sydney, Rachel Cusk. Rachel, the crowd's gone wild here. Thank you. I want to start by thanking you very much for giving way to our weeping and blandishments over many years and finally appearing at the Sydney Writers' Festival.
I finally get to visit Australia.
You do, and you've got an incredibly appropriate fiddle leaf fig there with you, so it looks like you're here. You're moving house right now, I know, and this seems a very Cuskian activity in which to find you. It makes me wonder, like, you're a writer that's always on a sort of relentless quest. Do you move house easily? Do you find relocation a wrench? Do you throw everything out and start again? What sort of mover are you?
I think I do move exceptionally often, I think, compared to other people. So I have thought about why this is. I think I can't resist the idea of beginning again. Certainly in my childhood, we moved frequently. I moved country twice, house many times. And so I think that I actually got an idea of a sort of narrative structure of life very, very early from these beginnings and endings and change and this idea that somehow you could write the story of life by an act of your own will, by choosing to bring an ending somewhere and you know, open up a beginning somewhere else.
Are endings ever really endings, or are they endings in art, and in life is it more messy?
Well, I mean, the question of what kind of mover are you? My instinct is so much that in the act of moving can also be the act of sort of dispossession and disburdening yourself, and essentially burning the evidence of yourself. So that is a very attractive prospect to me. And a couple of years ago, the University of Texas at Austin wanted to buy my archive, and all I could produce. So Norman Mailer has a whole corridor for him. All I could produce was a sort of small box of things that I had kept. So I don't know. I think then I felt that my burning of the evidence was I don't know, a little more tragic.
Certainly very thorough. what has this past year been like for you? I mean, reading your work, I associate you with motion and travel and probably through the trilogy, I imagine. And I think I intuit through that work that you're somehow always at a writer's festival. I know that's not true, but being on a shuttle bus from venue to venue or dining in a dimly lit restaurant, I wonder, what is your actual experience of writers' festivals, and do you miss them now that they don't happen so much, or that you attend them virtually?
Well, I think when the pandemic began and lockdown, at least here, began, a lot of, I sort of read or witnessed a lot of writers and artists saying, oh, well, this is how I live all the time. Now everybody's finding out what it's like to be me. And I mean, that seems in retrospect a slightly tasteless sort of thing to say. But at the time it did seem extraordinary that somehow this the solitude, whether enforced or chosen, of that is absolutely part of creative life, was something suddenly being communally lived and shared, and perhaps in people noticing that, there was some hope or belief that humans would embark on a more generalized creative process of their own, which, you know, I'm not saying at all that that's happened. So it was a very clear feeling, you know, for anyone who, as I say, lives in their own private lockdown a lot of the time, that this thing becoming a lived reality was sort of uncanny. And I mean, the question about writers' festivals and the loss of those things, you know, I found immediately that I slipped very easily back into the state of uninterrupted solitude, and to the extent that I actually felt I was revisiting my earliest years as a writer. I mean, even before I was published, that feeling of simply being alone with what I was doing, and it proved such a powerful return that I immediately wrote a book, which was second place.
Wow, okay, that's interesting. Do you find communion with other artists important? I mean, writers' festivals are such weird events, aren't they? I mean, I had a conversation with Amy Bloom, the novelist and psychotherapist, when she was here in Sydney a little while ago, and she said she found writers' festivals just this terrifying nexus of neurosis and need, and it was sort of a point where writers were together comparing themselves to each other, and, you know, room size and length of signing queues. I guess it's sort of defining for a writer to attend a writer's festival in that way. You get a kind of definition that you might not otherwise professionally get. Is that a kind of definition that you require or ever think about?
Well, I mean, the thing is that writing is pretty invisible, and it happens, it arises in the head of the writer, and it passes by a minimal transaction through the concrete to the head of the reader. It has no particular location. It has no particular evidence. It can, sort of happen in secret. And so I think for writers, the coming out into the world, the seeing of one another, it's like a room full of Robinson Crusoes. And so perhaps there is a slightly hysterical enacting of social forms. there is the consequence. I mean, I have found, I was very, very, very shy as a, you know, it astonished me when I was first published that writers were expected to be able to speak and to even to speak on a stage in front of an audience, which to me, the whole reason I had to write books was because I obviously couldn't function in life in that way. And so I was very shy and I had some fairly sort of scarring experiences early on of being very tongue-tied and in that situation. But in the end, you know, you get used to it. And yes, I've found that feeling of a fraternity, which in fact, you know, in this Zoom era, I like even more because it doesn't even involve flying around in an airplane or, you know, that, but that feeling of a fraternity, of a sort of a collegiate almost world of discussion and consideration. And, you know, there isn't, the world doesn't care that much about books. So it's, in the end, I've recognized it's a privilege, really, and a rare opportunity to actually talk about what you're interested in, like a room full of nuclear physicists, maybe. Oh, finally, I found someone who's as interested in nuclear physics as me. So that, in the end, is you know, what it feels like.
Now, I'm going to sort of work a little bit chronologically through your career, and then we'll come to your new novel towards the end. I wanted to start by talking to you about your very famous memoir, A Life's Work, which was written 20 years ago now, at the time of the birth of your first child. It's one of two occasions, I guess, notable occasions, on which you've used memoir as a form to examine great dislocations or occasions for rearrangement of identity in your own life, and where you're doing that has occasioned some fierce criticism of you as, you know, self-obsessed or cold or unnatural. It's a strange critique for me of that book that you wrote about becoming a mother, because I really experienced your writing about that as a very warm, almost to the point of fever piece of writing. But I wonder if you could talk briefly about the receipt of that work.
I think I thought that, in fact, I know I thought that paying attention to my life as a woman, or not my life as a woman, but what I had understood through becoming a mother was pretty much inextricable from female identity, unless you were alert beforehand and made a choice and thought, okay, here's what being a woman involves, and if I want to do something else, you know, I'm going to have to be careful about those things. But it seemed to me that having looked in the face this inextricable component of femininity, I had to reconcile my writer self with that. There was, you know, either I was going to do that or I was going to walk away from that truth and construct a sort of false persona. So, you know, the worst it seemed to me that would come from it was that, you know, I already felt invisible as a mother. That seemed to me an amazing experience in being erased and in you know, some fairly sort of technical ways. I don't mean that sort of as dramatically as it sounds. And I suppose I thought that writing about motherhood would render me more invisible and more erased as a writer, because it was so clear that was the status of that subject was very questionable. And you know, not only did men not write about it, you know, women shouldn't write about it. So in fact, the fact that it made me instead an open target for criticism was, possibly the most surprising thing that's ever happened to me, because it's the cruelty of that, given that, you know, although the way that I write memoir isn't, you know, it isn't cathartic or autobiographical, or, you know, it's the same as writing a novel. I just have different reasons for needing to put it in the first person. But it was still a good guess that the person who'd written this memoir was the mother of a young child, and that perhaps you should think twice before viciously attacking that person. So it seems the whole cruelty of the societal version of motherhood was sort of horribly proved and unleashed by me writing that book.
Do you think your sort of essential crime was to place yourself in the center of this story in a way that's sort of unforgivable for a mother, or was it your sort of failure to be more upbeat and chipper about motherhood in every respect? Because I did wonder, I think there is a difference. There's a different treatment to women who write about their own identities at great length. I mean, Philip Roth or Martin Amis or Saul Bellow can essentially carry on about their insecurities over thousands of pages and nobody seems to mind. But there's something sort of unnatural about a woman who examines herself to that degree.
I mean, I think that my process is easily mistaken for, and perhaps this is true of any woman writing autobiographically or using autobiography, that it's easily mistaken for self-obsession. I mean, I think there's so many, hypocrisies. A man in life as in writing, involving himself in parenthood, is encouraged and congratulated. Men of our time and of the past have often written more sort of feelingly about parenthood and children than women have. So, I mean, there's certainly I think my friend Sheila Hetty, who I think is a past attendee of this festival, yes. And who very often manages to say these things more boldly than I can say them myself, said about my work that, I'm very drawn to these areas where people, and especially women, are determined to lie. And I think that it's that clash that is somehow inflammatory in my work, that because I'm living things as a subject and I'm perceiving and observing at face value, I'm looking and listening and then going away and trying to work it out. So I can't have the kind of distance from it that Sheila's remark shows that she has that distance, that she can identify these constructed social areas where truth is very, very problematic. And I've gone at it in a very different way, which means I've been much more battered by those passages of life and have sort of staggered out, bearing my sort of conclusions about them and writing them down.
It's extraordinary that nearly a decade later you had the fortitude to go back again with another work of memoir about another seismic event in your life in the end of your marriage. How did that experience make you feel differently about writing or exposing yourself?
Well, I mean, to me, Aftermath was such a logical book to write, and I again didn't see coming the reaction to it. And in fact, it's interesting to me that in the years since then, I've come across or heard about so many examples of women creators, artists, writers who are also mothers being really viciously attacked for their womanhood, by the law, by divorce courts, by judges, and indeed, similar things happened to me. So, I suppose, this attack on your actual womanhood as a creator it was a life's work round two. I didn't see womanhood or femininity as being so implicated in the story of divorce as obviously I had done in the story of motherhood. But so it was a shock, you know, unfortunately, a sort of shock revelation that you know, in life and in writing, that is still a very, very gendered experience. So it, as I say, it felt like the necessary development and sort of conclusion to everything that I'd written about, you know, these structures we live by and you know, the struggle to find freedom within them and the consequences of trying to break them. But what it showed me was that I needed to do something much more to defend my right to investigate and express myself on these subjects. And so I think that, you know, that led me very, by a long but and difficult but pretty direct path to thinking I need to do something different to a novel. You know, if I'm going to make it do this work, you know, if I'm going to stop putting myself in the firing line by having to use memoir because it's the only available form for a woman who wants to actually write truthfully about, you know, ordinary womanhood, the ordinary experiences that pertain to being a woman, you know, nothing to do with literature, nothing to do with intellectualism. The memoir was all I had to do that with. And that, as I said, you know, you become an open target. So I had to make a different kind of novel so that I could write about these things and be better defended.
You said before publication was before Outline was published that you'd come to the view that fiction was embarrassing, that it was fake, and you said, once you've suffered sufficiently, the idea of making up John and Jane and having them do things together seems utterly ridiculous. But John and Jane are kind of a layer of protection for writers, though, aren't they? They're kind of like an alibi so that the writer can maintain that it's all totally made up and the guy in the book isn't really their husband. So, and I guess if you write from your own life, you risk hurt and injury to yourself and to others. So was that Outline structure an attempt to build something that described an outline without relying on the classic novelistic form?
I'm often invoked as this rather brutal and strict sort of critic of narrative and the novel and its ridiculousness. And you know, in fact, I think that there's a very clearly defined literary movement in our times away from imagination, away from narrative, which, you know, the novel had become a sort of bloated fantasy form in which, you know, too often writers were you know, being caught on the job, just, you know, writing whatever happened to be in their minds. So I think that there has been a recoil from that, a response to that. Autofiction is one of the names it goes by, but a recognition in all sorts of writers that the self is a method of verification. It's a correction to the untruths that can crop up in the exercise of one's imagination, and a correction to narrative having strayed very far from reality and the reality of people's lives. So I think a lot of people had come to similar conclusions around the same time, and I think in my case, because I'd used memoir in the way that I had, you know, at heart, you know, I really am a novelist, and my sort of sense of the novel has always been quite classical and possibly conventional even. So I think where my thinking took me, that was the reason my thinking took me to the novel form itself rather than to possibly more radical formats for autofiction or for, you know, writing in a different way. And it seemed to me that the main thing was to make the act of perception to turn it inside out so that the act of perception is on the outside. And that it has to be completely transparent, that the book has no knowledge of its own on the inside.
You've essentially sort of stripped everything away from your novels over the years, you know, characters, narrators. They are an exchange of overheard confidences that circle around consistently these questions of identity, of the dreadful things that people do to each other in love, to animals. I wonder, is this the essential building block of experience of life? Is that what you're trading in now? I know that you have written approvingly about Karl Ove Knausgård and his approach of retelling everyday life in this sort of incredible, brutal detail. Is that really the only thing upon which a writer is entirely qualified to comment?
What, their own, the material that they personally can verify? Well, I mean, I think the Knausgård project is a very different thing to do with masculinity and narratives about masculinity. I mean, in my case, it didn't feel so much of a making of rules or you're allowed to do this and not allowed to do that. It just did a very simple thing, and from that simple thing, that change made the landscape of the book look very different. And you know, one of the kind of driving forces in that was, which I'm not sure has been entirely understood, and why should it be, was the whole idea of the creative writing class, which is in Outline particularly, you know, very much the setting. And what I wanted to imply was a new form, in a sense, which is somewhere between speaking and writing. And I've had to call it writing in inverted commas, but it includes when people speak and find and give themselves utterance and find, you know, resolve and create in the act of speaking and speaking of themselves. And sometimes it is also actual writing that people do. So this kind of form or half form was really interesting to me because it seemed to sidestep patriarchal cultural models and to be something that I wondered in the end might lead me to understand the concept of a female voice. And even though a lot of the people who speak in the trilogy are men, it seemed to me that this mode of discourse was inherently feminine, that it had no location, it had no capital, it had no concrete manifestation. It winds around created works and it creates echoes and reflections of its own, and it is so often put to the service of, as I say, patriarchal culture. It is made to read and look and interpret, but actually, in terms of it itself, what this voice is, that became very, very interesting to me. And I think in the the thinking that I did next and that led me to write the book that I've just written, that really is what came out of the trilogy for me, is you know, what is this thing in the ether that is and is not a created product.
Well, you've brought us very neatly to second place. And I wonder, keeping in mind that no one in this very packed room has, well, very few of us have read the new book so far. And if you're happy to, I'd love for you to read a little bit of it and perhaps begin by explaining, you know, the story of the book, what it's about, and perhaps a couple of words on the real-life woman on whom the book is loosely based or by whom it's inspired.
One of the things that I found myself contemplating as well, you know, having written the trilogy and thinking, not being entirely certain sort of where that led to, because it seemed all about leading out of things rather than, you know, into somewhere that I could go. So those, you know, scruples, artistic scruples, were ones that I had, but, you know, at the same time, there was a larger scruple about entitlement, about who gets to speak, about who, I suppose, the white Western voice, its narrative, do we need more of it? Do we need more space taken up? You know, isn't it time for the space to be given to others? And you know, those thoughts were powerful for me, and the scruples that went with them. And by chance, I came upon a memoir written in the 30s by Mabel Dodge Lujan, who was an American patron of the arts, she's described, but she was, that's very misleading. She was a very complicated and interesting woman, and a great memoirist. And this is a volume of her memoirs telling of how she invited D.H. Lawrence to come. And so she was the so-called, I don't think it was ever as formal as this, but the patron of a sort of artists and writers community in Taos, New Mexico. But she was a great inviter of people to that landscape. And she invited him, and he came. And the extraordinary consequences of that arrival are written about in her book. And so I'm a great Lawrence, lifelong reader of Lawrence, and this was actually a part of his life that I didn't know all that much about, but it was also this voice, which was the voice of someone reacting to Lawrence, looking at Lawrence, being affected by him. And it suddenly, I'd always thought of him as a bit of an honorary woman because he suffered so much and was reviled in you know, for his honesty. But actually suddenly seeing him, this separation, what I felt I was hearing was the same sound I'd started to hear through the trilogy of this dispossessed voice. And so this book was an out-of-print book. It felt like an abandoned house. I thought, right, I'm not going to take up any new space. I'm going to go and live in this house, and I'm going to do something with it. And so I used her form, or I tried to update, transform, fill her form with something of my own. D.H. Lawrence is not a character in the book. It's a book about a painter. In fact, the person who she invites into her life is a visual artist. So the part I'm going to read is from the beginning, when she tells, the whole book is spoken, as Mabel Dodge Lujan's memoir was, to the poet Robert St. Jeffers, which again, I liked it being addressed to somebody. So I kept that. And anyway, so this is how when she's telling Jeffers how she first saw the work, came across the work of this painter who's referred to in the book as L, just by his initial. "You will want to know, Jeffers, which of his paintings they'd chosen for the advertisement and why it affected me in that way. There is no particular reason on the surface why L's work should summon a woman like me. or perhaps any woman. But least of all, surely, a young mother on the brink of rebellion, whose impossible yearnings, moreover, are crystallized in reverse by the aura of absolute freedom his paintings emanate. A freedom elementally and unrepentingly male, down to the last brushstroke. It's a question that begs an answer, and yet there is no clear and satisfying answer, except to say that this aura of male freedom belongs likewise to most representations of the world and of our human experience within it, and that as women, we grow accustomed to translating it into something we ourselves can recognize. We get our dictionaries and we puzzle it out and avoid some of the parts we can't make sense of or understand, and some others we know we're not entitled to, and voila, we participate. It's a case of borrowed finery and sometimes of downright impersonation. And having never felt all that womanly in the first place, I believe the habit of impersonation has gone deeper in me than most, to the extent that some aspects of me do seem, in fact, to be male. The fact is that I received the clear message from the very beginning that everything would have been better, would have been right, would have been how it ought to be, had I been a boy. Yet I never found any use for that male part, as Elle went on to show me later, in the time I will tell you about. The painting, by the way, was a self-portrait, one of Elle's arresting portraits, where he shows himself at about the distance you might keep between yourself and a stranger. He looks almost surprised to see himself. He gives that stranger a glance that is as objective and compassionless as any glance in the street. He is wearing an ordinary kind of plaid shirt, and his hair is brushed back and parted. And despite the coldness of the act of perception, which is a cosmic coldness and loneliness, Jeffers, the rendering of those details, of the buttoned-up shirt and the brushed hair and the plain features unanimated by recognition, is the most human and loving thing in the world. Looking at it, the emotion I felt was pity. Pity for myself and for all of us. The kind of wordless pity a mother might feel for her mortal child, who nonetheless she brushes and dresses so tenderly. It gave, you might say, the final touch to my strange, exalted state. I felt myself falling out of the frame I had lived in for years, the frame of human implication in a particular set of circumstances. From that moment, I ceased to be immersed in the story of my own life and became distinct from it. I had read my Freud often enough and could have learned from there how silly it all was, but it took Elle's painting to make me really see it. I saw, in other words, that I was alone, and saw the gift and the burden of that state, which had never truly been revealed to me before.
M, the woman in the book, is begging for definition, to be seen by this artist. She's convinced that he can see and define her in a way that she can't do for herself, in a way that will somehow settle the matter. Where do you think she lands, and where do you land on that question of relying on someone else's recognition of you for definition of the boundaries of yourself?
Well, I think there's sort of two parts to the answer to that question. And one is something that I felt powerfully when I first read or heard the voice of Mabel Dodge Lehan, which was the feeling of women in an era when they were beginning to really realize what the constraint of femininity was. That having been, you know, given some elemental freedoms, talks about Mabel Dodge Lehan as the male female, you know, an example of the male female in sort of this period where everything that your desires for freedom, your desire to express yourself, is as a woman, what you're almost feeling is that you're identifying male qualities. Those are male qualities, and you are identifying them in yourself. And you're either very ashamed of them, or you try and sort of dress yourself up in them and adopt a you know, some masculine forms of life. So that idea, for a start, seemed to me very still very pertinent, and in terms of how gendered concepts of freedom and self-expression still are, you know, right up to a pretty high level. And I mean, the part about the need for someone else to express, to give you expression, you know, very much flows from that. There's a line in the book somewhere where she says, I had remained a devourer while wanting to become a creator. And I think that feeling of almost a war between male and female in oneself, where the risk of creativity versus the reward of being, you know, feeling recognized through someone else's art, someone else's risk taking, is a question that you know, for me, still for women, is a very, very difficult one to answer.
I was really interested to hear your comment about taking up space and the thought that you had given to this question of whose experience is written about and whose words are the loudest. And I know sometimes I've read criticism of you that is about the fact that you restrict your observations largely to the social class that you occupy. But at the same time, at the moment, of course, there's an incredibly live debate about writers who colonise the experiences of others, you know, white writers writing black characters or disabled characters or trans characters or and so on. Where do you stand just in general on that question of inhabiting the identity of another for creative purposes?
Well, I guess for me, you know, this book was an interesting exercise in, you know, what felt to me like wearing a mask. It felt much more like playwriting than novel writing. And, you know, drama is somewhere where the writer does have to fully imagine others and allow them to enact themselves. So it's a very different, that you're not pretending as the writer to be that person. You're actually, like a sculptor creates an image, you know, you are having to create the image of a person and convince others that they exist. So it felt to me, the second place felt more like my experiences of doing that. Sort of adopting a mask. I mean, you know, I've never felt entitled to use my imagination, as it's called, to trespass that boundary into, you know, out of what I know and into what I don't know and into knowledge that is owned by somebody else. Seems bad manners, bad art, and I've I've always been clear about it. And I can't help what I am. I can't help that I'm the social class I am, or so it. You know, I get a lot of sucker out of reading people like Annie Ernaux or Sheila Hetty, who, you know, who likewise are using the materials to hand, using what they've got, and that's what I've always done too.
What does your distaste for the classic fiction form as a practitioner extend to your practice as a reader?
increasingly, yes, but probably always, yes. And, you know, that's not to say that it's impossible to write about others, other things, other times, other places, other people. But understand, I mean, sometimes you know, genre is the way to do it. You know, my child is a great reader and writer of science fiction and believes that that is also an autobiographical form. You know, the Gothic was the way that women, the Brontes, you know, first found a way of writing the truth about themselves by sort of inventing this paradigm. And so you know, it's a part of, it is a form, it's a part of artistic practice. But in the way that it is, or has been very often practiced in the world of contemporary fiction, it seems, I think I've said before, and it sounds worse than it is, but it seems very, very much like pornography to me. At this point, the use of narrative form and imagination, and so I'm wary of it, as plenty of other writers are.
When we started this conversation, we talked about your house moving practices, and I was shocked to hear that your archive was so modestly proportioned. I'm a terribly cluttered person myself, so I don't move house because it would just destroy me and everyone around me. But it makes me wonder about your relationship to your earlier work, and particularly your much earlier work, the novels that you wrote early on. What do you make of them now? And I'm emboldened to ask, from your mention of your science fiction loving daughter, I'm not sure if she's the same daughter who was the one, the baby in Aftermath,
A Life's Work.
Yes, sorry, A Life's Work. What does she think of that book?
Oh, I don't know if she's read it or not. They are free to read or not to read, as they like.
We have a questioner lined up at the microphone who you cannot see, but she's very friendly and she's smiling, and I think you'll be able to hear her.
Hi there. I've been reading Coventry, one of your essays collection, and I was wondering, I was very drawn to the chapter about defining women's writing, and I was wondering, where do you think in the future defining that space kind of falls, particularly with your work in motherhood and that kind of thing?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, everyone admits that part of how feminism failed in the 1960s and 70s, how it failed actually probably to transform women's lives and create more equality, was that it did not really address, you know, the basic sort of work, motherhood, domesticity. I think that more creating about and around those areas, more vocabulary, more language structures and image structures. You know, you think of what a Tracy Emin or a Louise Bourgeois has done in the visual medium, you know, for insights into the materiality of femininity, you know, as a bodily experience, as a psychological experience. You know, writing is frustratingly conventional. It frustratingly does not, it creeps to the edge and looks over and sort of runs away again. It doesn't advance in the way that the other arts do, and that's because it has to stay in the middle. It's like a centre governing party. It has to stay in the middle and reconcile, you know, the extremes of life. And so edging it towards, you know, a greater familiarity with what the female voice sounds like, what the female experience looks like. That seems to me a big and worthy job that is in hand.
Hi, Rachel. My name's Lily. I'd read an interview with you a couple of years ago where you spoke about the trilogy and how the writing process was quite quick for you because you had held the novel in your mind for quite a while. And so I was wondering, you know, a lot of novelists find the writing process through editing and they get a lot of the writing out and they feel the shape of it later on. So I was wondering, what does holding the novel in your mind look like? Is that scenes? Is that conversations? Is that locations? And what is that process is like for you?
Well, that was a habit I picked up from having small children and not very rarely being free to write something down when I thought of it. And I ended up having to keep lines and often entire paragraphs and pages, you know, very much word for word in my head so that I wouldn't forget them. I evolved a great ability to do that and to remember and actually unspool, you know, this great skein of material out of my brain and you know, the next day or whenever I had the freedom to do that. And in the end, that became more habitual than I intended it to, I suppose, and it revealed to me a lot of virtues. It seemed to me that knowing everything about what you were going to write before you wrote it, because so much happened in that holding moment, so much happened in that space that I reconsidered the material in a very particular way, that I tested it against lived life in a particular way, because I hadn't committed it to paper. It could be tested and reconsidered, and because, you know, there is something about words on the page that it's an economy, and once you've got them there, you're very reluctant to get rid of them, and you know, they tend to dictate, you know, the next line and the next line, and I guess that to me is too much an analogy of like how life actually works, and the one place I thought I'd try and do a bit better in aiming for perfection, you know, was writing. So and yeah, I guess in the end I thought I would not embark on a journey if I didn't know where I was going, if I didn't have everything I needed, my wallet, my keys, my passport, my, you know, I would need to know everything about where I was going. I wouldn't just sort of walk out of the door and expect everything to be all right. So, so that became a very intentional process in the end. And I mean, a bit of a burdensome one, because it means that 80% of my life I appear to be unemployed and very little time spent writing.
Thank you. We've got another question up under the eaves. You are loitering with intent, I assume, at microphone 6. You may speak.
Thank you so much, Annabelle. Thank you for the wonderful talk and just like time to be very pensive, I find, which is the same with your books. And I am not a mother, but reading especially the Outline trilogy really gave me this space to think about, I guess, my own like childhood and the space that my mother gave me and like her role as a mother and maybe giving her a bit more visibility than she was given. But one thing that I've been interested in is the way you spoke about this male voice having a location in the novel. And not to turn it into a binary, but this idea that the woman's voice maybe doesn't have this like central location or temporality that a man does. And when it comes to motherhood, thinking about how every generation of mothers feel like they're the first to be a mother and this experience that's really daunting. And I wonder if with your books, you kind of looked to other spaces of motherhood or whether it was like the process of being literary and like looking to other stories of motherhood or whether the creation of Outline and your narratives were a way to make space for this narrative of motherhood that wasn't there.
The feeling that you mentioned of every generation, every mother feeling like she's the first mother, not just every generation of mothers, is an aspect of the psychological experience of having a child and the inability to relate it to any other type of experience or even to feel that it involves your self, because you are being used by life. That is clear. Life is passing through you and reproducing itself, and who you are, you know, doesn't matter all that much. I do think that for women of my age, which is 54, perhaps we are the last, I sincerely hope so, whose lives are so the opposite to their mothers' lives. We have nothing in common, a lot of us, nothing in common with our mothers at all, and can't look to them for, and often they are rather ambivalent about what they perceive as our greater freedom or opportunities. So I think that the difficulty of friendship between generations of women, which I actually think is a something that could change societally. I think there's a little bit of fighting. I think I'm not a person who ever knows anything about what's happening in the world or what's on the internet or da da da. But I think that, you know, there is some intergenerational feminist fighting that goes on, and a feeling that older women have that they're being, you know, not asked for their wisdom by younger women. It would be good for more of, you know, that's, we want power. We don't want to be scattered and divided into factions. You know, more of that intergenerational female conversation, whether you're a mother or not. You know, you everybody needs a mother, and it doesn't have to be your biological one. And it's pretty good to have a child too, even if it's not your biological one. So I think that those conversations are essential. And you know, what would be, I guess, completely transformative of everything would be if mothers were given permission and support to transform themselves, to transform the whole discourse of motherhood, and it's the way it imposes behaviours, even dictates how you love, what kind of love that is, and how it's expressed. And you know, in my small way, I tried to challenge some of those discourses and expectations, and got, you know, fully beaten up by, you know, women, by mothers. They did not want that said. And, you know, so there's a lot to be done. There's a long way to go on that front of telling the truth. And as I say, it's something that we should do together.
Rachel, that is a perfect conclusion to our discussion. And this is a very large crowd, and we will let you go back to your move, and everyone in this room is going to disperse through the streets of Sydney and go home thinking about the things that you've said tonight. But I can't let you go without, on behalf of all of us who have, I think we feel like we've accompanied you a little bit along the way in your career, and loved your writing for its ease and elegance, which belies this extraordinary structure that you managed to construct and yet conceal at the same time quite magically. And also for the way that you have put yourself in harm's way as an artist in the pursuit of truth in a way that hasn't always been very easy, but it's clear through everything you write, the extent to which you do the work. And that is a great gift to a reading audience, and we thank you for it and for joining us here in Sydney tonight. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.